Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's neuroscience research podcast. Today is April 18th, and we're talking with Nancy Philp, who is professor of pathology and genomic medicine at Sidney Kimmel Medical School at Thomas Jefferson University. Nancy studies cell and tissue nutrition and metabolism, especially in the retina, although I see she's actually studied lots of other interesting cell biology topics. Hi, Nancy, and welcome.
Hi, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Erica Tatiana Camacho, who is professor of mathematics and also neuroscience, developmental, and regenerative biology here at UTSA. This is Tatiana's first time on the podcast, but almost certainly not the last, I think. And she makes mathematical models of metabolic dynamics and has collaborated with Nancy. Hi, Tatiana.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
And me, I'm Charlie Wilson. So Nancy, each of the sensory systems seems to have some like special, unique features that make them super interesting. The retina has more than its share of those, but one of them is that it's really a part of the brain, and so has a bunch of neuronal layers that really look like brain, and then it has a receptor epithelium, a sensory epithelium stuck right on that, and it's got, so that means it's got two sides. Sort of a brain side and epithelium side, and the vasculature on both sides. And on the neuron side, which is the inner side, the vasculature looks like brain vasculature. It's got tight junctions on the endothelial cells, and there's very strictly controlled movement of substances between the blood and the tissue. But on the outer side, on the neuroepithelium side, the receptor cell side, there's a completely different kind of arrangement that is more lenient and allows more interaction between the blood and the tissue. And so once in the retina, and then just like in the brain or any other tissue, nutrients that have made it in there move around and are often passed off between cells and processed by cells and given to other cells. So could you start us off, and maybe that's a lot, but if you start us off with a little tutorial on the two sides of the retina and how they get their nutrients and what controls that, and then maybe we can talk something about what the cells in the retina do for each other to process nutrients and deliver them to each other. Is that okay?
Wait, yeah, that's certainly. So the retina has one blood-brain barrier, but the retina has two, and as you said, the inner retinal vessels are like the capillaries found in the brain, but the outer blood-retinal barrier is formed by the retinal pigment epithelium, and like the capillaries, they have tight junctions between them, and there are polarized epithelia, but it has a unique polarity. There are some proteins that are involved in trafficking. If you compare the retinal pigment epithelium to the kidney, in the proximal convoluted tubule, they have a different distribution of proteins. And so we've looked at the differences in the distribution of solute transporters and some unique metabolic pathways expressed in the retinal pigment epithelium to try and unravel its role in supporting the rod and cone photoreceptor cells, which are the sensory epithelia of the neuroretina.
So the control of substances between the blood and the receptor cells is not so much like just a wall, a barrier. It's more like an active process that the pigment epithelium is enforcing by taking things up and crossing, moving things.
Right, they're the border patrol.
So what are the key substances that are being regulated there? I suppose ion concentrations, but I'm thinking more about.
So there are certainly, maintenance of there are ion channels that have a distinct distribution. But what we've been interested in, if you look at the most abundant proteins that are in the retinal pigment epithelium, they're glucose transporters and lactate transporters. And the retinal pigment epithelium has a unique lactate member of the SLC16 family monocarboxylate transporter. They're called MCTs. And MCT3 is found in the basolateral membrane of the pigment epithelium, where it modulates the transport of lactate out of the retina. So over 100 years ago, Otto Warburg found that cancer cells and retina, the neuroretina, both produce a lot of lactate through aerobic glycolysis. And aerobic glycolysis is when pyruvate is converted to lactate and transported out of the cell, even in the presence of oxygen. And so when I went back and read the literature and, you know, realized that the photoreceptor cells are they're like sensory epithelial cells, not like neurons, that they express proteins that are characteristic of cancer cells, like pyruvate kinase, the M2 form, and not PKM1 that's found in most other cells. And so it also directs glucose through pentose phosphate shunt and regulate redox potential in the cell. And so it's been proposed for many years that the retina was used aerobic glycolysis, but we didn't know which cells in the retina were actually the glycolytic cells, because in the brain, it's the model that's been developed by Pellerin and Magistrati, is that the astrocytes that have their end feet on the endothelial cells in the brain take up glucose, metabolize it through glycolysis and aerobic glycolysis, and produce lactate that they shuttle to neurons. And it is controversial whether this goes on in every region of the brain, but there is evidence that it does occur. So we sort of assumed, if you looked at the expression of the glucose transporter GLUT1 in the retina, it's primarily expressed by Müller glial cells in the neuroretina. So we assumed that it was the brain model where the Müller glia would metabolize the glucose and provide lactate to the photoreceptor cells. But by knocking out the glucose transporters in a cell-specific manner, we were able to show, in fact, the photoreceptor cells that express low levels of the glucose transporter GLUT1 are actually the cells that are using aerobic glycolysis in part to support their unique metabolism, where they are depolarized in the dark and they hyperpolarize in response to light. So they have the sodium channels are open in the outer segment in the dark. So they're transporting sodium out of the cell by sodium potassium ATPase, which is an ATP dependent transporter. And also, they renew their outer segments every day. So 10% of their outer segment is replaced every day. So they're sort of like a cancer cell, that they have this huge metabolic load of synthesizing proteins and lipids to make new membrane discs.
So is there, I mean, obviously they have a huge energy demand. Is there some advantage to being purely glycolytic? Why not use all the ATP-generating mechanisms you can?
Well, we know they're not purely glycolytic because even years ago, someone, Barry Winkler, showed that without oxygen, you can shut down the light-stimulated responses in isolated rat retinas. So if you have a lot of glucose, it can respond for a short time, but in the long term, they need both. I mean, I think we always want to simplify things and say that a cell uses oxidative metabolism or they're glycolytic. And I think even one end of a cell can be doing one thing and another end of a cell can be doing something else. And I think it depends on the activity of the cell at any given moment.
So photoreceptors definitely have ends.
Yes.
So is it the outer segments are doing one thing and the inner segments another?
I think it's really the part that we forget. I mean, there's been a lot of attention paid to the outer segment because the light sensitive G protein coupled receptor rhodopsin binds 11 cis retinal, and when light hits it, it's converted to all trans and starts a cascade to close the sodium channels. But so there, you need the inner segment to generate cyclic GMP, a lot of metabolites that move out to the outer segment, but they're an organelle-free zone. It's just a stack of these very thin membrane discs that contain rhodopsin.
So they definitely don't have any mitochondria.
They don't. They're all in the inner segment and at the synapse, depending on if it's a vascular or avascular retina. And I think some of the initial studies on retinal metabolism were done on hamster, which is an avascular retina. So the results the metabolism in an avascular retina is different than in a vascular retina. And even the thickness is different because things have to diffuse.
So lactate that gets generated by the receptor cells, is that treated as something to get rid of, or is that then used by some other cell in the retina for aerobic metabolism?
So because the retinal pigment epithelium has the MCT1 lactate transporter on its apical membrane, which is a higher affinity transporter, and MCT3 on its basal membrane, we thought that that distribution of higher affinity and lower affinity would allow the levels of lactate to rise in the pigment epithelial cells. So then the lactate could be used for oxidative phosphorylation. It was proposed that the conversion of lactate to pyruvate also generate LDHB that converts lactate to pyruvate binds to the lysosomal membrane. And so the proton produced in that process, it's thought is transported into the lysosome to decrease the pH. And that's been shown in some white blood cells.
Epithelial cells are kind of phagocytes, right? They're eating that.
Right, they are phagocytes. And so we thought that the lactate might have multiple roles in the RPE, that one, it could be used as be converted to pyruvate and used for oxidative metabolism. It may play a role in modulating the pH of lysosomes, which would fit together in a very convenient package. We're not sure that it's true or not, but it makes a nice story.
Leaves the Müller cell out. The Müller cell is losing its some jobs. Do you have some ideas about the metabolic specializations of the Mueller cell?
Well, if you look at the Mueller cell, it's like a pipe, and it extends from the outer limiting membrane where photoreceptor cells and Mueller cells form junctional complexes. And it has apical processes that extend into the subretinal space. And then it moves through the retina and to its end feeder on the vitreal surface. So, and in addition to that, it's a radial glia. So it has processes that radiate throughout the inner retina. So it really, I think it knows what every cell is doing and what they need. So one hypothesis we have from that knockout animals we've made, where we've knocked out GLUT1 in rod photoreceptor cells and Mueller glia, is if you, we saw that glucose depletion from the media wasn't changed when you knocked out GLUT1 from Mueller glia. So when you have an isolated retina sitting in a dish, not much is happening. But we thought that the Mueller cells could take up the excess glucose because their processes don't extend all the way up the inner segment. So they get the leftovers and then recycle it throughout the retina, because as the glucose moves through this tube, wherever they're facilitated transporters, so if there was a glucose was lower in a region, it could be transported out by GLUT1. So
it's the only cell that stretches the whole way across,
right,
the retina, which is quite a substantial distance, and there's no vascularization inside the neural part. Right? So the very middle of the retina
is,
has to get its nutrients from the two sides.
Right. No, okay. So it turns out that there are capillary beds, the most superficial layers on the vitreal surface, then the inner plexiform layer, there's another capillary bed, and then in the outer plexiform layer where you have photoreceptor cells and bipolar cells and horizontal cells in there, there's another, the innermost vessels.
In the synaptic layers, there are vessels.
Exactly. So, but still, you know, the vessels are about 100 microns apart. I mean, so this would just provide, if glucose was lower in an area, then it could diffuse out. And then at the end feet of the Mueller cell, if their glucose came all the way down, it could be made into glycogen, as could lactate. Yeah. So that's why we think that it might be redistributing these metabolites made by the photoreceptor cells.
So when you're saying photoreceptor cells, you're usually talking about rods. But the cones, are they the same? Are they different?
No, cone photoreceptor cells have a different metabolism than rod photoreceptor cells. I think that they can it's been proposed that they can use lactate produced by rods to fuel their metabolism. They have very large mitochondria and more mitochondrial mass in their inner segment than rods. And they also have the outer segment is much smaller, so they don't have as much of an anabolic load as a rod photoreceptor cells. But I think they require more ATP for color vision. So it's probably the cones. Are more sensitive to oxygen deprivation And there was a group who, from Marty Friedlander's lab, who knocked out VEGF from the retinal pigment epithelium, so the capillary bed underlying the RPE was reduced. And rod photoreceptor cells were viable for a long time, but within a much shorter time, about 7 days, cones were dead. So it really shows we have the opposite effect. If you, in glucose deprivation, rods die and their outer segments become shorter, but the cones are fine, and it may be that the inner blood, the capillaries in the inner blood retinal barrier can support cone function, in both in terms of supplying oxygen and as well as other metabolites.
So do the cones, you know, use the lactate from the that's released by other cells, or are they reliant on glucose as well?
No, I think that they're more, they can use other substrates other than glucose, because when we knock the glucose transporter out of cones, we didn't see, when we knock GLUT1 out of cones. The other thing is there may be a special relationship between horizontal cells and the cone synapse where glucose can be released and then taken up at the synapse, even by endocytosis. So
the horizontal cells may feed the cones.
Yeah, there may be feeding from the horizontal cells to cones. And I forget who made that hypothesis. And sorry, not hemidesmosomes, hemikinexins. Uh-huh. Sorry, it's connexin channels.
Yeah, because connexins will allow glucose through.
Right.
Well, how many different, you know, one of the things that's confusing about this for most of us is that we learned a lot of these metabolic pathways in school, but we forget them. And
that's why Google's so wonderful.
So just wondering, how many different energy sources, molecules, are there in there that cells could use? How complicated are the options for a cell?
Well, I think the major options, like heart, everyone knows uses fatty acids because fatty acid oxidation for ATP. But then there was a hypothesis that rod photoreceptor cells also oxidize fatty acids, but it may be a very small part of their metabolism. But the retinal pigment epithelium, forming the outer blood retinal barrier, we found, not other people have found too, but we rediscovered that they have the gene HMGCS2, which is an essential gene for ketogenesis. And because we know that ketones wouldn't be high enough in the, and also first we found that MCT7, another member of this monocarboxylate transporter family, was highly expressed in photoreceptor cells. We thought, okay, maybe they're using ketones, but the ketones wouldn't be high enough to be transported in, so they had to be locally sourced. So we made this hypothesis that the retinal pigment epithelium ingests outer segments and then uses fatty acid oxidation. And by ketogenesis, then provide an outlet. You make ketone bodies that don't feedback inhibit any of the pathway in fatty acid oxidation. So it seemed like an excellent system, but when we knocked under normal conditions where we didn't stress them mice with a Western diet, there was really no change in either the structure or the function of the retina in terms of changes in the electroretinogram or changes observed either histologically or by optical coherence tomography. So we think the RPE is very flexible. And so even though we had this, you can make a model that seems perfect based on the proteins. And, you know, I was thinking that if you look at the distribution of transporters, it helps you figure out how metabolism is flowing. And in cancer cells, we saw that fibroblasts in breast cancer cells years ago, we published this paper that fibroblasts upregulate GLUT1 and MCT4, which is expressed in glycolytic cells and transports lactate out. And so the activated fibroblasts were feeding the oxidative cancer cells. And so, you know, it was sort of a simplified model of what's going on.
So one thing you might think about having all these different forms of metabolism is that it would give the cell some safety for changes in circulating levels of various things that they need. And you just mentioned something about Western diet. I suppose that means cheeseburgers and french fries or something like that. So,
and high fat and fructose.
So you don't challenge the mice with that kind of stuff.
No, there are a lot of people who are doing all these Western diets. And one thing is there's a group in Boston, Alan Taylor's group, that showed that the Western diet impacts the microbiome that then impacts the retina.
That's a long way around.
Right. But, I mean, there is this whole gut-brain axis. So, I don't know. I think what it tells us is you can start small, but then you have to integrate your problem into the whole system. And that...
Is there a large group of human disorders that are metabolic disorders of... that harm the eye? I mean, I know there's some.
There is, the lactate transporter MCT3 that's specific for the retinal pigment epithelium, mutations in that do cause retinal degeneration. There are just a few cases, but, unlike the brain, where if you have a mutation in one allele of GLUT1, you get glucose deficiency syndrome, which is can have an array of symptoms and severities, but overall there can be cognitive deficits and epilepsy and some motor deficits. And so far, in most of them, people haven't noticed a retinal phenotype. So it may be that the blood flow in the choroidal vasculature is so fast and the capillary bed is so complex that they get enough glucose. But with aging, glucose deficiency has been thought to contribute to neurodegenerative diseases, and it may also contribute to diseases in the retina. But if you have capillaries falling out, you're also altering every other nutrient and oxygen. So you have to
separate
things.
Diabetic retinopathy, for example, that would actually end up influencing as well the blood flow in the eye, but also certain other systems that might affect the metabolism as well.
Right, but I think that, and I'm certainly not an expert, but I think that, well, one thing that happens because in diabetic retinopathy, you can get an increase in glucose levels in the retina, but you also can get, because the glucose flowing into the retina isn't regulated as much at the RPE as it is in the brain, in the endothelium, in the capillary. So, and I think that there are capillary dysfunction in capillaries and periocytes. There's a disruption of the inner blood retinal barrier in diabetic retinopathy.
Well, I had to end thinking about something like that, but it's time for us to finish up today. So thank you very much, Nancy.
Thank you.
And Tatiana.
Thank you.
And this has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.